Pastor Harding, if you'd like to go ahead and come on up. Pastor Harding is going to be the first of our speakers today. And I'm not going to give an introduction for every one of these speakers, but I do want to give an introduction for Pastor Harding. And I'm going to say a lot of nice things because he got pretty beat up last year for all those who were here last year. When it comes to the theme, Shepherding the Shepherd, I've only been a senior shepherd for not even a year here at this church. So I did not consider myself qualified to lead this conference as far as the topic, Shepherding the Shepherd. But Pastor Harding is the first man I thought of who's somebody who's been a Paul to this Timothy, so to speak. And just to illustrate this, Pastor T.J. Klaprich is speaking today. Pastor Alan Benson is speaking today. I am Pastor David Huffstetler who's speaking today. We have all been shepherded by this shepherd who is about to speak to you. Scott Aniel grew up at First Baptist of Troy. We're going to have Pastor Mike Riley pray at the end of the day. And he has been shepherded by this man. I asked this man to preach on shepherding the shepherd because he is a shepherd to shepherds. And for all the other men, these are men who have been pastors or have trained pastors or both. And I think that you'll find that it's not just what they say, but it's the experience that goes behind what they say. For most of them. I can't say that for myself. But for these men, you will be blessed today. So Pastor Harding, we're so thankful to have you and all of you other speakers today. So please break open God's word if you would.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate that very much. I told our church yesterday that we're having a PhD reunion here. Mike Riley just got his PhD. Scott Aniel got his PhD about 2 years ago. And Dave Huffstetler just got his PhD in Christian leadership just about a week ago. And Chairman, my deacon said, well, you just tell those three men that experience trumps education. And it's good to see Jim Lawler here as well. Jim was on our staff. He's pastoring in New Lenox. And Jim and Sharon are with us today as well. So it's just a blessing. And we have Ben, who is also our junior high youth pastor, Ben Michalik, and Tim Michalik, who is an assistant at a nearby church and considering the mission field. So it's good to have these men with us as well. A great blessing. Your notes are there. And this is something I prepared some time ago, but I'm only going to concentrate on a section of those notes, particularly pages 4 through 6. But I want to begin by saying that Donald S. Whitney, who is a prolific author on pastoral ministry and biblical spirituality, has taught pastoral theology for decades on the seminary level. And Whitney makes an astounding observation. He says, for every 20 young men who graduate with a seminary degree and actually enter the ministry, only one of those 20 men will remain in the ministry until he is 65 years of age. And Whitney lists about a dozen reasons why men do not last in the ministry. He says many leave on account of finances, loss of good health, problems in the church, denominational politics. Whitney's a Southern Baptist, so he brought that into the consideration. Pressures from their immediate family, a burnout, ethical issues, lack of training. Nevertheless, discouragement, said Whitney, lists as the number one reason why most men do not survive in the pastoral ministry. And really, the casualty rate is shockingly high. R. Kent Hughes and his wife Barbara, back in 1987, wrote a book about this. And they entitled the book, Liberating Ministry from the Success Syndrome, which chronicled their early struggle in a small church. And having gone through that small church and all the struggles that went with it, this was the result of that ministry. Well, having written the book, it really found a place in the hearts of hundreds of pastors. So he and his wife were traveling the country, and Dr. Hughes was speaking on this subject in hundreds and hundreds of churches. After he spoke at these churches, here's the comment that Kent Hughes makes. He said, pastors as a group are one of the most hurting and abused segments of our society. And the reports that Hughes and others have heard firsthand from thousands of pastors and pastors' wives, I may add, He said, and I quote, "would tax the credulity of the uninitiated." Hughes suggests that the success syndrome has dramatically increased on account of Christian radio and internet. He says, and I quote, "a top handful of Christian preachers and teachers giving their best stuff, edited and packaged with artistically interspersed background music, causes the average churchgoer to find that Sunday fare is quite pedestrian and dull in comparison." I think we all know what that feels like. You know, you're walking out of church, you've just preached, and someone in your church comes up to you and says, "Well, Pastor, I have a tape, or here's a CD of a great sermon I heard from Dr. Frank Lee Terrific, and you really need to hear this. It'll help me stay awake during your sermons." Hughes, in his book on the success syndrome, he accuses the American big business mentality of dividing the world into big fish and small fry. In other words, you have the CEO of Walmart Church, and that obscures the proprietors of the mom and pop church. Remember one of our speakers, I think it was last year, who said he walked into his church and there was a man who had been in the church for years, didn't know that the pastor was also in the auditorium. And he was just standing there looking at the auditorium, and he took a deep breath and he said, "I think it's time for a change." Of course, the pastor was in there and heard him say that. Of course, that sunk the heart of the pastor. And the pastor made the comment, "Could you imagine going home, looking around the walls of your house, your wife's in the room, but you don't know it. You say, I think it's time for a change." Well, you're going to have to see a marriage counselor after that. But that's exactly what happens so often in our churches, that people get this kind of attitude, this restlessness. Another reason that Hughes cites for the success syndrome and the damage it does and the discouragement it creates is what he calls American individualism and subjectivism. You know, the underlying attitude that I can go it alone without membership, without active participation in the local New Testament Christian church. Well, that might be the case, and I think we compare the so-called infallible magisterium of the inspired popes and we come down on that. But equally heretical is the individual magisterium of one's own subjective opinion. And these things are raising their ugly heads in our churches, and the pastor in that responsibility realizes that pastoral authority is evaporating while individualism and subjectivism are reigning. So we really do have a leadership crisis in our churches, and frankly we have a generation of beat up clergy and aimless churches that are really drifting aimlessly in the pagan seas of a hostile culture. So against all that, we have a responsibility, I think, as pastors, to not only encourage younger men to go into ministry and help them as they make preparation to go into ministry, but also to help one another. I had a pastor come to see me one time, and he said, "You know, Mike, we're in a rare fraternity." He used that term, fraternity. He was a seasoned pastor in a church very close to us, and he was having great difficulty in his church and eventually had to leave the church. Not because of any wrong that he had done, but just the general unrest in the church. And I never thought about it that way before until he said it, but I do think there's truth to it. There is a certain fraternity amongst pastors that we understand the work of God in a different way than people who have not done that. Dr. Les Olo used to say, "I don't go to work, I wake up in the middle of it." I think every pastor knows exactly what that means. I mean, you just wake up 2 in the morning, 4 in the morning, you get out of bed. I've learned, just get out of bed. It's easier to get out of bed and do something than roll around tossing and feeling anxious about something. So get out and get a good head start on the day. So I thought, what would be the most helpful thing for us to look at shepherding the shepherd? And I had prepared this some time ago, but I thought this really fits what we're trying to do here. And so I'd like to use Barnabas as the biblical example of shepherding shepherds. So it's in your notes, and it really starts on page 3. You can read pages 1 through 3 as a precursor to pages 4 through 6. I think it'll be a real help to you in understanding how to shepherd younger men and one another. But the real heart of the message really is Barnabas. You can read a lot about leadership. I think leadership is basically initiative and influence. Leaders initiate, leaders influence. I've been reading Dr. Al Mohler's book on leadership and had lunch with him about 3 weeks ago. My son's a research director for him, so we had lunch with him on a Sunday afternoon. And I was talking to him about how he became the president of Southern. And he said something that was very unusual. He said, "Honestly, Mike, I think I was born for that job." In fact, that's what he said to the search committee. Can you imagine that? Now, I tried that at Bob Jones University. It didn't work. Did you say stillborn? So they took Pettit. I was 2 honorary doctorates short of qualification. But he said that. He said, "I was born for this job." I thought that's such an interesting thing. You know, from most people, that would be a brash statement. From him, he said, "Yeah, I think you were." And really has done a remarkable job there when you consider what he inherited and what it's become since. It's not an endorsement, but it is an observation. Well, while we were talking there, you could just tell that he had a great burden as well to influence a generation of leaders. And he wrote his book called Conviction to Lead about that. It's an outstanding book. And in that book, Conviction to Lead, and it's on the book table in the back, you'll see it there. It takes a completely different approach of leadership. Most leadership books are about management. And this book is not about management. This is leadership from conviction. And it says that the heart of spiritual leadership is a man who not only has a reasonable IQ and intelligence quotient, but he calls it an emotional IQ. You have to have emotional intelligence. He says you have to have ethical intelligence, and you have to have, beside that, a convictional intelligence. That there are a multiplicity of intelligences to lead a work of God. And oftentimes, he says, "I've met many academians who were very, very bright, but could not lead at all because they lacked an emotional intelligence or ethical intelligence or convictional intelligence." And he felt that convictional intelligence was the heart of leadership. He was absolutely on target, and his book argues this point, and it is an extremely helpful book on leadership. So what kind of man evidenced these various intelligences in the Bible? I really do think Barnabas is the man who shepherded shepherds, both those under him, those equal to him, and those who were actually beyond him. And there are 6 categories in which he showed shepherding shepherds. And the first one, we'll be working our way through the book of Acts here. We'll start in Acts 4. We see Barnabas as a sacrificial giver. His initial name is Joseph. He's a Levite from Cyprus. And he is presented in the book of Acts as a sterling example of the spirit of generosity. Acts 4:32 through 37 tells us that he owned a tract of land. He sold it, brought the money, and laid it at the apostles' feet. Because of this act of generosity, he was nicknamed Barnabas, which is the Aramaic for son of prophecy. But he also is described by Luke as the son of encouragement. This monetary gift is the first in the series of ministries of encouragement to which Barnabas dedicated himself. This is an area that we can help other men in the ministry. Can we help them financially? You know, for young men who are in our church, we have always spent money for decades and decades paying for most, if not all, of their seminary training at a nearby seminary by us. Nobody actually told me to do that. It just seemed to be the right thing to do, the best thing to do. We had a very good seminary, it was very inexpensive, and what better way to invest our money in future leaders than to help them with their seminary training? There have been many, many men that we've done that with, and we're still currently doing that. And I would encourage, you know, you as a pastor, if you have a young man in your church and he's seriously interested in the ministry, find a way that your church could help him go to seminary. That's very, very helpful. Also, you can help other churches in your area. There are many churches in your area that need some financial help. My son-in-law took a church of about 20 people. It was going downhill. The church had pretty much gotten to the place of extinction. And we've been helping him substantially on a financial level, on a people level, to rejuvenate that church. It's now called Gibraltar Bible Baptist Church. And they're averaging about 50 in attendance. They started with 20. They've had a high recently of 70. He works very, very hard. He's also going to seminary, Detroit Seminary, and we're paying for a seminary to do that. But that financial help made so much difference to them. I was recently talking with a friend of mine who's in the ministry going through a very difficult time and almost was pushed out by the deacons of his church. And the first thing I said to him, I said, if this happens, we'd like to help you in some way. And so I sent him some money to be a blessing and a help to him. Sacrificially giving for people behind the scenes. You know, when pastors are out of work, they're really out of work. There's no safety net for pastors. And I've always been amazed of the callousness, not only in church congregations, but even amongst other pastors, toward pastors. And I'm not talking about men guilty of immorality or thieving money or things of that nature, but just impervious to the trial that a pastor faces when he is no longer desired at his church. Where does he go? Who wants to help him? And I spent a good bit of my time trying to help other pastors get over those hurdles. Had a friend of mine who was leader of a parachurch ministry, a camp ministry, and was let go after many years. And so we brought him back to our church. I had a place where he could live. We put his family there. I gave his wife a job in our school. I found him a position of painting for family in a church nearby. And for several years, we just helped pick them up for about 2 or 3 years. He's now pastoring in Connecticut and doing very well for the Lord. And I thought, you know, if our church wasn't there to be a blessing and a help to him, he could easily get embittered. He could be sullen in the ministry. His wife would say, perhaps I never want to go back in the ministry again. I've heard pastors' wives say that after their husbands were pushed out of their pulpits for one reason or another, and heard it with my own ears, and the wife would say, I never want you to go into the ministry again. I never want you to be a pastor again. Heard that very word. And it breaks my heart when I hear that. So I think it is incumbent upon us as fellow pastors to do what we can. Not all can do the same. But we should be able to do what we can to care. I don't know if it goes back to my roots. My dad he passed away 10 years ago, but my dad was the business agent for Jimmy Hoffa. Just remember that next time you insult me. I'll take you out to lunch on Telegraph Road. It'll be your last lunch. But my dad, for his whole life, he was a truck driver, his whole life drove 4 million miles for Roadway Express. But my dad always was very concerned about the other truckers and what would happen to them if they lost their jobs. I saw that almost every day of my life. And I'm not endorsing unions. I know all about unions. I've lived with it my whole growing up years. But one thing I can say is that you saw a sense of brotherhood amongst those men. They really did care about each other when they were down and out of work and didn't know where the next meal was going to come from. And I don't see that always from pastors. I've always thought that pastors should care about other pastors in this way. And there are even men who perhaps have disqualified themselves from the ministry and should never be a pastor again. But where do they go to rejuvenate their family? How do they save their marriage? How do they save the posterity of their family and have children not turn away from God? Do you step in there? I think you do. Did that one time with a pastor that had disqualified himself, and I invited him and his family to our church, and we did everything we could to be a help and a blessing to them because I didn't want to see his marriage break up and I didn't see his children go to hell. And that's what happens in these cases. I'm not exaggerating. So being a sacrificial giver. Number two, a bridge builder. After Paul's conversion, when he first arrived in Jerusalem, the disciples were unwilling to receive him. He was a former persecutor. Acts 7:58 says that Paul had stoned Stephen, and the witnesses late the Jews had stoned Stephen and the witnesses and laid their robes at Saul's feet. Chapter 8, it says Saul had ravaged the church. He was dragging men and women into prison. Chapter 9, verse 1, he had breathed threats and murder against the disciples. Even Paul's own testimony in chapter 22, verse 3, I persecuted the way to the death. So it's natural for the disciples to fear Saul, that he was pretending. He's trying to infiltrate their ranks in order to do damage to the church. And that's what Acts 9:26 tells us. They were all afraid of him, not believing he was a disciple. So this is where Barnabas steps in. And Barnabas steps in, and he actually believes Saul's testimony. And it says in chapter 9, verse 27, that he laid hold of Saul, and he brings him to the apostles. And he says that Saul had seen the Lord, that Saul had talked to the Lord had talked to him, and that Saul had spoken boldly in the name of Jesus. So Barnabas relates the story of Saul's conversion, and he now becomes a trusted advocate and witness for the Apostle Paul, now named Saul at this time. So he's a bridge builder. I believe godly pastors try to build bridges with other godly pastors. We have to be careful that we don't burn all our bridges. I've been associated with Bob Jones University. I've been associated with Fundamental Baptist Fellowship. I appreciate those organizations very much. Are they perfect? No. And there really aren't any perfect Christian organizations, to be candid with you. And I think sometimes we get so perfectionist that we have fellowship virtually with no one. And I think godly pastors try to build genuine bridges. And I've learned that if you build bridges, it's actually good to cross the bridge. Actually have some kind of relationship with that person. Sometimes, as Dr. Bowder has eloquently argued, there are different levels of fellowship we can have. I can't have Dr. Moeller in my pulpit. I wouldn't do that. But I can have lunch with him, and I've done that twice. And I've learned a certain level of respect for him by doing that. I think that's helpful. I think godly pastors are bridge builders in the sense that they understand that there are godly people there that you can learn from, and you ought to be very cautious and careful what you say. I wasn't always this way. I think I was quite reckless, frankly, in the early years of my pastorate. I meant well. I was zealous, but not always according to knowledge. But through 30 years of pastoring at Troy and 6 years at Oak Forest Baptist Temple as an assistant, I do believe that it's wise to build good bridges to godly people, realizing that there are different levels of fellowship that you can have with folks. And that's an encouragement to people. I was talking with Steve Pettit recently, and he has preached in hundreds of churches over the last 3 decades. And he has a little bit of that perspective as well. He's been in all kinds of churches, and he's seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. He told me, he said, I actually saw the difference between King James only and King James ugly. He says there is a difference. And he's not advocating at all that position, but he realized that if you actually interact with people and talk to people, you do gain a better understanding. And it's easy from seminary 101, lunchroom 101, talking shop, to get a little theoretical and idealistic and not actually have those face-to-face conversations with people. It does change your perspective a bit. Well, here's a man that everybody had reason to separate from, Paul. I mean, Saul was just a murderer, that's all you can say. And yet, Barnabas took the risk, and it was great risk, to be an advocate for Saul and see the potential in Saul. And I think godly pastors do that. They see potential in people that you normally wouldn't see. Met a young man in our school, it was about a month ago. He was at one of our educational conferences we had at our church. And I hadn't seen this guy in years. Big guy, strong, just bulky guy, barrel-chested and bald. Looked just like Dave Dorn. Except less hair. And I hadn't seen this guy in years. Found out he was teaching at a Christian school north of us, serving the Lord, working with these young people. Well, the last time I saw this young man, we shipped him from our school. I didn't know what happened to him. And it was just a joy to see what God could do with him. You know, I never would have dreamed that young man would ever do anything for God at all. I had good reason not to let him come back to our school. had many reasons, actually. And here he is. He turned out to be, frankly, one of our outstanding graduates. I've had graduates I've given every award you can give them to, and they turned out to be zeros for God. You can't really tell. Bridge builder, willing to take that risk. And there is risk in ministry. You know, you reach out to somebody, develop them for the Lord, you really don't know how it's going to pan out. But there is risk in ministry. If you have an aversion to taking risk, I don't see how you're going to accomplish anything for the Lord. Because we don't, frankly, have any guarantees ahead of time what's going to happen with somebody's life. The third avenue I see as encouraging other young men and pastors is being a teacher. And the story here is of Barnabas with Paul, now Saul, now saved, and they're as a missionary team. And they go to Antioch, and they meet there certain Greeks that have been coming to the Lord, and Barnabas sees evidence that the grace of God was at work in their lives, and it says in chapter 11, verse 23, that he witnessed the grace of God, he rejoiced and encouraged them all with absolute or resolute heart to remain true to the Lord. Here he is, a teacher, and he's teaching these Greeks. Now, he had to avoid certain cultural issues with the Greeks, and I think he learned what is culturally significant and culturally not significant. I think he understood that. He remains true to the Lord, and Luke mentions that Barnabas, in this context, is a good man, morally upright, generous-hearted, chapter 11, verse 24. And through their ministry, they saw a great number of people come to the Lord. The point is, he was a teacher to those who needed to be taught. Every leader is a teacher. All teachers are not leaders, but every leader is a teacher. And that's what I see in this man, a one who's willing to teach. Of course, if you're going to teach, you have to be taught. That's a hard thing for us to learn. When I was first pastoring at First Baptist of Troy, I had an undergrad in Bible from Bob Jones, had an MA in theology from BJ. I thought I was ready, prepared. And then I made the mistake of hiring Dave Dorn as my youth pastor. That was a huge mistake. Dorn started pulling my sermons apart. And then he invented this little phrase, boy, you just sucked that one out of your thumb. I didn't even know what that meant. He got it from McCune. I thought it was a pretty good sermon, but apparently it wasn't. Then I hired Juan Marino to be our school principal. It was my second mistake, because they were teaming up against me. And they're both going to seminary, and they're evaluating my sermons, and I'm getting shredded on Monday morning. I'm telling you, these guys are just doing a number on me. So I had to say, well, maybe I need to go back to school. So I went back to school, started doing my MDiv there at Detroit, then a THM there. It took about 10 years altogether. But it was because of their influence in my life, and the smartest decision I ever made, other than getting saved and getting married to my wife, Jenny. It was just a great decision. But I realized if I was going to be a teacher, I had to do the hard work of being taught. And I worked at it very hard while I was a full-time pastor. It was very hard, a lot of early mornings, late nights. It was difficult. But I thank God that I had a good seminary within 45 minutes of me to do that. I'm very thankful for that. I think if you're going to influence other pastors and you're going to influence younger men in your ministry, you have to do the hard work of being taught so that you can be a teacher. I mean, how am I going to influence guys like Mike Riley or Dave Hostetler had I not gone through that kind of work? I mean, these are brilliant guys. How do you have that kind of influence over men to have these aspirations? I often thought the reason I have so many PhDs coming out of my church, they said, well, if Harding can get a THM, I know I can get a PhD. They're absolutely right. But you're not going to have that kind of influence. My son's finishing up his THM in December. I am absolutely convinced that I could not have had the teaching ministry in my life had I not gone through the hard and rigorous work. And it was hard, very difficult. One of my seminary professors is here today, and I took many classes from him. And it was hard to make those trips over there, all the extra work, plus you're preparing 3-4 messages a week. That's my wife, tell her I'm busy. But being a teacher, and you can't teach unless you're constantly learning. And it becomes a joy to learn. Though it's hard work, and it's blood and brain sweat, it is worth doing. Number 4, developing of a promised leader. The leadership team in Antioch is led by Barnabas, and there's five in the team. Barnabas is listed first. Saul's listed last because he's probably the least significant member of the team at this time. And Barnabas and Saul have been set apart by the Spirit to pioneer work in Cyprus and Galatia. Now, John Mark is with them, and he's the young cousin of Barnabas, by the way. They're related. And they are going on this mission endeavor, and after they completed their work in Cyprus, they go north to Perga. And there, John Mark leaves them in Perga, and he goes back to his home in Jerusalem. Now, Mark may have been homesick, he may have been ill, he may have been unable to withstand the rigors of the work. But let me suggest another reason why John Mark may have left. When you look at the narrative, it points to a change in leadership of the team. It goes from Barnabas being the leader over Paul, or Saul at that time, to Saul, now Paul, taking the leadership. And we see this initiated in the terminology in chapter 13, verse 9, where Saul is designated for the first time as Paul. And until that point, it had always been Barnabas and Saul. You look at Acts 11, verses 26 and 30, chapter 12, verse 25, and chapter 13, verses 2 and 7. In all those cases, it's Barnabas and Saul. Now, it's the opposite. So when they get to Perga, it's Paul and his companions, chapter 13, verse 13. So Paul is now the leader of the team, not Barnabas. And it's recognized that way basically through chapter 13, 14, and 15. There's about 9 occasions where Paul is cited first. And to me, the scene in Lystra is really telling here. It says in chapter 14, verse 11, the gods have become like men. They are comparing Barnabas to Zeus, and they're comparing Paul to Hermes, the chief speaker. So now you have Barnabas in the sense of mentor and teacher in the background as Zeus. You have Paul as Hermes, the chief speaker. And so the people now are recognizing that Paul has surpassed Barnabas in prominence. And so now Barnabas is no longer considered the leader of the team. Remember, there's a relationship between Barnabas and John Mark. And perhaps it was that change of relationship that bothered John Mark. But the indication here is that Paul now is in the forefront as evangelist and preacher. For 7 years, Barnabas had introduced Saul to the work in Antioch. He had developed his skills in teaching and evangelism. But there's this gradual ascent in leadership. All you men know what it's like to have an assistant pastor or a young man in your ministry who eventually surpasses you in preaching, teaching, evangelism, trailblazing new territory for the Lord. I've got plenty of people like that. I got Pastor TJ here. Without question, the finest preacher ever on our staff. Without question. And every time he preached, I knew it. And I love to hear him preach, and I bring him back. And had I considered leaving Troy a couple years ago and going to another church, and I had actually talked to TJ about coming to our church, and would he be willing to do it? And it would have been a step up for our church, to be very candid with you, because he's just such an outstanding leader, preacher, teacher of the Word of God. He's a brilliant man. I rejoice in seeing men go beyond any abilities I have. You men have experienced the same thing. You might have had an assistant on your staff, a younger man, who when you first brought him on, he knew little, the next to nothing. You knew a lot. And then eventually, through training, through experience, through skill, through natural ability that God had given, through natural talent, he just rises above you. And that's okay. In fact, it's actually good. And Barnabas is a very godly man. I don't think it bothered Barnabas at all, but it may have bothered John Mark, who was related to him. Whatever the reason for John Mark leaving, he did leave. But nevertheless, Barnabas was the developer of a promised leader. And by God's grace, when you see young men in your church, you have to realize they might take your place one day. They might do a better job in that part of the vineyard than you ever could. Not because you didn't want to or desire to. It's just God had gifted them differently than you. And that's okay. I was driving home from Bob Jones just the other day after our graduation recently, and I'm listening to Alistair Begg on the radio, and he's talking about jealousy. And he says Saul and David had a jealousy issue going, particularly Saul. And he paints this picture of an amphitheater of thousands of people standing there. And they are shouting in a cheer-like form, Saul has slain his thousands. This isn't just one person saying this. This is a a stadium full of people saying that. And you can just imagine Saul. He likes that. Saul has slain his thousands. That's good. And then David has slain his tens of thousands. This, in the original Hebrew, is really a chant. Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his tens of thousands. And this green monster of envy and jealousy rises in Saul to the point that he becomes a murderous man. Beg goes on to say after that, that jealousy comes in our lives when we refuse to rejoice over the successes of others. And we have to rejoice over the successes of others. That is hard to do as pastors. And you know what Beg said in the sermon? He said the hardest place for pastors to go is a pastor's conference. And you're paying for this abuse. Not a lot, but you're still paying. You know why? Because, you know, somebody's going to say, well, we're having this success or that success, and you're thinking about your church, and you're just trying to keep it going. I figured out a long time ago in my church that I lose 10% every year to Greenville, South Carolina, the promised land. I'm not kidding. I was down there not the other day at David Community Baptist Church. And the pastor says to me, Mike, do you have anybody left in your church? I said, well, why do you ask? This is from the pulpit on a Sunday morning. Getting picked on even there. And I go, well, yeah, we do. He says, well, I've had so many families from your church come to our church. I just wondered, did you have anybody left? I said, oh, I'm down here to reclaim them. That's why I'm here. We really do have to learn to rejoice in the successes of others. I want my fellow pastors around me to be successful. And I want our young men who are in the ministry to be successful. And I realize that God has gifted them in ways that I will never have. And I know that. And I'm okay with it. You have to learn to be okay with that. If you can't learn to rejoice in the successes of other people, how are you going to ever develop a promised leader? You really want to rejoice in that. Number five, a defender of truth. And this is a situation where Barnabas actually had failed in Galatia. You remember that he had made the same error of Peter. It certainly was a flaw in his life, but eventually he overcame it. And we're told that when the Judaizers from Judea came to Antioch and demanded that the Gentile believers be circumcised and obey the law of Moses, Acts 15:1 says, Paul and Barnabas had great dissension, not with each other, but with them, and debate with them, and they vigorously defended justification by faith alone, the defender of truth. Here's another way you can encourage your fellow pastors. Take a stand. Take a stand. I was talking with one of our pastoral assistants on the way up, driving yesterday afternoon after church. He said, you know, Pastor, I was reading on so-and-so's blog, and they brought up the question of egalitarianism and complementarianism, and about the fact that a certain Christian college was allowing or had allowed female Bible teachers to instruct their Master of Divinity students, and that the new president was disallowing that now, and this well-informed, well-instructed man was throwing on his blog, what do you think about this? In other words, he wouldn't take a position. Just threw it out there to his friends. Of course, his friends are throwing it, well, we think this is terrible, it's sexist, and all kinds of politically correct names. And my assistant said to me, he said, you know, Pastor, that's discouraging to me. That a man that well known, that well taught, that well trained can't take a stand on something so clear in the Bible. You encourage young men by being a defender of truth, putting your neck on the line. And that doesn't mean you're a heresy hunter. It doesn't mean you're becoming eccentric on minor points. But you're willing to put it all on the line for the gospel, for the whole counsel of God, for significant and clear doctrines of God's word. And you almost have a reckless abandon when it comes to those kinds of issues. I have found that that encourages my brethren. I'm encouraged when my other fellow pastors, when I see Dr. Dorn taking a good stand on an important issue, that encourages me. I know he doesn't pull the trigger very quickly, and so when he does pull it, I know it's pretty serious. He's not quick on the trigger, as I have been in my past ministry at times. But it does encourage me when I see other good, godly men take a clear stand for God's glory on biblical truth, a defender of truth. And then finally, the restorer of a failed brother. Can't go into the story here, but according to chapter 15, verse 36 and 37, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us return and visit the brethren in every city." And Barnabas wanted to take John Mark with them. So Mark comes back to Antioch from Jerusalem. But Paul kept insisting that they should not take him along. Well, they had a harsh disagreement, as most of you are familiar with, and I give all the details here. And it ended up having two missionary teams. When I look at this story, I really think Paul may have been too harsh, and I think, frankly, maybe Barnabas had been too lenient. But nevertheless, 5 years after this, you have Paul citing Barnabas in 1 Corinthians 9:5 as an example of a brother. He says, "Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, or only do I and Barnabas have that right?" So he repaired that relationship. 12 years later, AD 62, Paul sends greetings to Mark, who is with him in Rome, from Mark, who is with him in Rome, to the church at Colossae, chapter 4, verse 10 of Colossians. He also sends greetings to Philemon in verse 24 and mentions John Mark. Of course, the famous text, 2 Timothy 4:11, "Pick up Mark and bring him with you, for he's useful for me for service." A striking commendation for a previous deserter. You know, the patristic evidence shows that Mark became perhaps the amanuensis for Peter. I'm not sure that's the case, but Carson Moo and Morris in the introduction to the New Testament make that case. But eventually we know he wrote the Gospel of Mark. In the end, Barnabas had a policy of giving the young man a second chance, really produced some great results. It takes little foresight to carp at and harshly criticize and deflate the stumbling young hopes of inexperienced men. You know, when our young men make mistakes, and they do, and I made plenty of them, or maybe make decisions that are somewhat risky, I try to be very patient with them. There comes a point in some cases, and I've had to do this, where I did draw a line and said, we have to break ecclesiastical ties, and I have done that. But I don't do it quickly, and I don't do it easily, and I realize that young men are struggling through many, many issues, and the ecclesiastical scene isn't quite the same it was when I graduated from Bob Jones University in 1978. And things are a little more confusing out there. And so I try to be very patient with the younger men, that even though they might do some things I wouldn't do, I wouldn't be comfortable doing, I try to be careful not to just break it off with them. Because if I do, I don't have the influence on them. And I do believe in second chances, in the sense that, not in a moral field, but in other areas where they may have made a decision that wasn't wise, or it didn't turn out the way they anticipated. If I break my connections with those young men, what influence can I have in their life? How can I watch over and protect them? How can I have any kind of ministry with them? So I think a restorer of a failed brother, and the failing here I'm talking about is the failure of John Mark. It wasn't a failure of morality, perhaps. It was a failure of ethics or a failure of character, failure of perseverance or tenacity. You're going to have people in your church go into the Lord's work, and they're going to make mistakes. They're going to have failures. They're going to do things wrong. And hopefully you're a patient person, and you'll correct it. You'll talk to them about it and encourage them, but you won't throw them under the bus, so to speak. I think they have to see that kind of love in you. They have to know that's the kind of person you are as a pastor. That when pastors make mistakes, and we all do, try to help them. I've had friends of mine that have grown up in our church and have had to leave a church, not because of any immorality, but just perhaps a lack of wisdom, lack of leadership, a lack of emotional intelligence. But I've tried to be an encouragement to him. I've tried to help him. I've tried to say, hey, God will still use you. You have many talents and many gifts from God. God can still use you. That's how you shepherd shepherds, in my opinion. You don't demand that they be absolutely perfect, flawless people. Blameless doesn't mean that in 1 Timothy 3:1. Blameless is defined by the qualities after and their basic characteristics of the life. They're not absolute perfections of the life from day one. No one, including Paul, would meet that standard. Paul wouldn't have met it. But it is the general characteristic of that man's life. Titus 1, verses 5 through 8, 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 9. Blameless is defined that way. But it doesn't mean flawless. It doesn't mean absolute perfection. If that's the case, nobody goes into ministry. Instead of 1 out of 20 surviving the 65, it's 1 out of 1,000 to 65. And that's where we end up. So in my understanding, Barnabas is the example of how we as fellow pastors can shepherd each other. There's no big fish and small fry. There's no Walmart church pastor and the mom and pop pastor. We're all equally important in the eyes of God. We all have an equally serious responsibility. I told Bruce McAllister very recently, who's a former ministerial director of Bob Jones University, I mentioned one of the men in this room, and I said to him, Friday, as I picked him up to speak for our graduation, I said, and I named the pastor, I said, he has a small church, but I said, Bruce, I would dare say he's one of the finest, if not the finest pastor I've ever known. He has a small church. No Walmart pastors, no mom and pop pastors. We're equally important in the eyes of God. We should be encouraging to one another. And by God's grace, see those numbers go from 1 in 20 to much higher. So that by 65 or 70 or whatever age God would allow us to serve, we could serve for the long term and be a blessing and a hope to other people. And see precious young men like this go beyond us because of God's gifting in their lives. Father, thank you for this time we've had together. We pray it'll be profitable in your name. Amen.